internet. Welcome to episode 2 of the Assorted Calibers podcast, the Second Amendment podcast that has a little bit of everything. With me is my wonderful co-host, Aaron Paulette.
Hi, Weird. I'm in a good mood today.
Oh, that is awesome. It's great to be in a good mood. And hey, guess what? We have one episode done. I am so excited about that. Aaron,
yeah.
Did you know that I have been on podcasts of some capacity or other for over a decade? But this is my first time doing the production stuff, and it's sometimes a little bit scary.
Wow, they had podcasts a decade ago? I had no idea. I mean, I know that sounds sarcastic, but no, I really had no idea.
Just barely.
Oh, so not only are you the podcast bicycle, but you got in on the ground floor. So in many ways, wouldn't this make you the podcast Penny Farthing?
Ooh, my first podcast was coal powered.
Yeah, so that first episode, it was fun. We both had a good time with it. We obviously have some very good chemistry. But wow, we were fumbling like virgins from prom night, weren't we?
A little bit. It's a new show. You've got to get the feel for it. Also, the pre-recorded segments are scripted, but I wanted this part to be more organic. So that means there's going to be some weirdness going on. And let me say, one thing that I did do is I made a couple of big mistakes. Well, some are some audio issues. Hopefully this one sounds better than the last one. We're always learning. But also, I totally forgot to acknowledge the creator of our music. That's Mr. Nate Spencer. I've known Nate since we were teenagers. And despite him having a background in bluegrass music, he writes some serious rock. Also, I forgot to mention that I do another podcast every week. And that is Handgun Radio, hosted by my good friend Ryan Machad. And so, Ryan, we've been friends for a long time, and he's been so much help over the production of this show. And he was the guy who told me that Savage 1R was interested in talking about cryptocurrency and other interesting stuff. So, yeah, if you like the Savage segment, he's at fault. If you don't like the Savage segment, he's at fault. So let's go on to the topic of the day. YouTube is bringing out a new policy on guns. I'll say at the time of this recording, me, like everybody else, is just speculating on what this means. Here, let me do a little quick read. This is from NPR. Very interesting that NPR is reporting on Second Amendment issues. According to NPR, starting next month, YouTube will ban videos that offer instructions on how to make firearms and accessories, such as silencers and bump stocks. It will prohibit content in which firearms and accessories are sold both directly and through other websites, and videos on how to install firearms modifications will also be barred. So, seriously, think about that.
I'd like to congratulate YouTube on becoming the MySpace of video hosts.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, that's the tough part with this, is they are absolutely like the 500-pound gorilla in the room, but so is MySpace. So the term too big to fail is really not an accurate term. Just ask Kmart or Sears.
Okay, so here's the thing, and I apologize if I'm explaining things that everybody already knows, but YouTube has been making a series of bad decisions that I think are really starting to hurt it. I could be wrong. I don't know much about the economics of YouTube. So a couple of things that are going on. First of all, there was the great demonetization a while back, where they stripped the monetization of pretty much all videos that didn't have a fixed number of subscribers, and those subscribers were pretty high. And a lot of those channels were people who did a lot of streaming and Twitch gaming and things like that. And those people then moved their content to another video host that I don't remember at the moment. So there's already been one exodus of content. And YouTube has also been pushing pretty heavily its subscription-based YouTube Red, where you pay so that you don't have to sit through all the advertising that YouTube forces you to download an ad blocker so you don't have to see it. And this, to me, is just one more in a series of bad decisions that will drive people away from it and into the arms of Dailymotion or Pornhub, like we've seen. Pornhub, gosh golly, doesn't like censorship, and so it's taking in all of these Second Amendment channels. And I don't really know why exactly YouTube is doing what it's doing, but it seems very committed to shooting itself in both feet, and now it's moving up to the knees. And that's why I said it's going to become the MySpace of video hosts, because no one uses MySpace anymore. They all use Facebook, just to, you know, absolutely beat that analogy to death.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting view, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, because, yeah, who knows? I mean, YouTube is such a big thing. I mean, I'll be right open. YouTube is my television. I sit down at the end of the day, and I watch YouTube videos to unwind, and there on the sidebar is a varying degree of things. And that's one thing that bothers me, is as it drives out certain groups, you're ruining the diversity of YouTube. And that's what I like about it. I sit down and watch a YouTube video. I'll be watching In Range TV where Carl and Ian are shooting guns. And then next thing you do, I'll be watching a cooking video and learning how to cook something. And then I'll be watching a car review. And then I'll be watching somebody fishing. And then I'll be watching Dr. Matt Carricker, who does Demolition Ranch there on YouTube, which I think he's most famous for. But I didn't really get into the Demolition Ranch videos. I got into his Vet Ranch videos where he was doing veterinary medicine. That was way more interesting for me. And I love that. And I love that they're all in one place. And I would hate to see it split up into different groups where, oh, all the gun people, you go here, and all the cooking people will stay on YouTube, and the gamers will all go to Twitch, and so on and so forth.
The thing that makes me shake my head is that YouTube doesn't produce anything. It sells advertising, but that's because the advertisers know that people watch videos. YouTube doesn't produce videos. They host it. And they are dependent upon people uploading their videos to YouTube so that people will watch the YouTube channel. They are actually turning away content which they thrive on. Now, I know that YouTube has so much content on it that you probably couldn't watch it all in one lifetime, but it really seems like they are doing their absolute very best to turn people away. And you know, when you turn people away and you demonetize their videos and you tell them that they're not welcome, they take away all of their content. And they take away their audience. And they take away the audience that would buy the things that are being advertised. And this just seems like a bad decision all around. It's all political virtue signaling. Now, I had an idea. And I actually sent this idea to the relevant authorities. And I don't know if it's ever going to take root, but I think it's really cool. So here's what I think should happen. I think the NRA should develop its own video hosting platform. And they should make a big deal about how the Second Amendment protects the First. Which is why they are now hosting this video platform where you can talk about guns and politics and all sorts of things without censorship. I think this would be freaking amazing.
That would be pretty cool. And what would be even cooler is with open arms, they could offer space for Michael Bloomberg and all the anti-gunners to put their videos up because, hey, guess what? I'm the guy that's constantly looking through YouTube for anti-gun stuff to Fisk. And let me tell you, it's kind of thin on the ground. You type in any sort of gun term into YouTube, and you're going to get a million and one pro-gun videos, and maybe down at the bottom you'll get something anti-gun.
Yeah, and they could make so much political capital out of that. Well, look, even though we're pro-gun, we believe in freedom of speech, so here we will allow these anti-gun people to make their statement on our platform. Isn't that generous of us? Neener, neener, neener.
If only the NRA was that smart.
Well, okay, this is totally bragging. I actually happen to know the president of the NRA, Mr. Peter Brownell, and I've conversed with him a few times, and I sent him a message, and I told him my idea in far more detail. I haven't heard back from him. He's very busy. He's CEO of Brownells and the NRA president. I don't expect a whole lot, but I hope he listened and I hope he's putting it into action. And really, that's the best I can do. I can whisper it in his ear and hope he does something with it. Although, if you do something with it, I totally deserve 10% of the revenue.
Call it Palette Tube.
You know, I think they should probably get away from the whole tube thing, but I couldn't come up with anything better. I mean, lots of people are saying Gunny should start their own video host and call it GunTube, and okay, yeah, that would work, but you're still referencing the old censorious platform, and I think we should do something that just jettisons that tube suffix altogether.
Says you. I mean, it's on the internet, and we all know the internet is a series of tubes.
The internet. Why? Tubes. The internet is tubes. Connections, consumers, massive.
I get the feeling there's probably some sort of liturgical response I should make, but I can't think of one. So, speaking of YouTube, Weird, I understand that your next patented audio fisk actually came from YouTube.
That's exactly where I got the audio that you're about to hear. Today I bring you another talking head calling for gun control. This time it's Megyn Kelly of the Today Show in the wake of the shooting in Parkland, Florida.
There have been at least 12 school shootings in America so far in 2018. It's February 15th. We're averaging one just about every 3 or 4 days. How we doing, America? Everyone okay with that?
Well, let's touch on this a bit. She's doing this whole monologue in the aftermath of a school shooting. And weeks later, this story is still generating headlines. And yet she's saying we're getting more than one of these events every week? Have you heard about them? I sure haven't. See, Meg is not being totally dishonest. She, of course, isn't citing her sources. By the way, Megan, I do, and you can find them in the show notes. But I've covered similar misleading numbers on my blog. You see, most deaths by guns are suicides, which doesn't fit the laws or narratives of the anti-gunners, and the vast bulk of the remainder is inner-city violence often tied to gangs and or the drug trade. School shootings, like the one in Parkland, are really so exceedingly rare that they reach statistical noise levels, which isn't good for the corporate gun control lobby who wants to push fear so they can convince people to ratify laws they wouldn't support normally. So Michael Bloomberg commissioned a study where now every event that involved a gun near a school is now a school shooting. This, of course, covers drug dealers doing their ugly work in the halls of the local high school or college, but also when gangs shoot it out near a school, and in several cases, a student commits suicide on campus, even if school isn't in session, it becomes a school shooting. I guess this isn't a lie, per se, but when spoken directly after mentioning the shooting in Parkland, it does imply that the numbers are related.
We all know what is about to happen right now, don't we? We're going to say how sorry and shocked and sad we are, and then we're going to move on without doing anything. And then we'll express how sorry and shocked and sad we are at the next one, and the one after that. Does anyone really think that we are going to do anything after these mass murders?
Well, that's more than a little disingenuous. If this cycle plays out the same way as past political frenzies have, members of the corporate anti-gun lobby will implore that the anti-gun politicians draft legislation that is boilerplate agenda, but has nothing to do with this event. Cooler heads will prevail, and hopefully some real problems will be solved. Though for the corporate anti-gun lobby, sadly it won't have much to do with guns.
Let's face it, it's not all on them, because we the people are the ones who hire and fire these politicians, so if we don't get serious, neither will they.
Interestingly, the politicians pushing this corporate anti-gun agenda live in the small enclaves of anti-gun America, like Megyn Kelly's own New York. So Megan isn't really making much of an effective argument. Instead, she's preaching the status quo, because those who are agreeing with her likely already live in the areas represented by an anti-gun politician, and those who don't are represented by the people who fight back against this agenda. It's almost like our government was designed to work like that.
5 years ago, I was live on the air and pregnant with my third child when 20 first graders were shot to death in school in Newtown, Connecticut. That was the one. That was the one where we all thought, now we will do something. Now we have to change.
First up, remember that first clip where she claimed we were having more than one school shooting every week? Now she's talking about Newtown. Again, this implies a Newtown or a Parkland is happening every week, which really it isn't.
If 20 dead first graders don't spur people to action, what will?
Well, action was taken. The anti-gun politicians pushed Michael Bloomberg's universal background check bill that would make private selling a firearm illegal, as well as making the commonplace practice of lending a firearm to a friend a felony conviction. all in the wake of a shooting where a sick individual murdered his own mother so he could steal her guns and her car and take those things to Sandy Hook Elementary School, walk past the no guns allowed sign, and shoot people who were legally mandated to be unarmed until the armed police showed up. When the cops did show up, the killer didn't even confront them. He simply took his own life. So Megan, the anti-gun forces did do something, but it was irrational, draconian, and ghoulish, as it used the deaths of innocent children to push an agenda item that had nothing to do with their deaths.
Yes, there was an act signed into law by President Obama just about 15 months ago targeting mental health reforms. It pushes for early intervention for kids showing signs of mental illness. But guess what? It hasn't been funded by Congress. It's a beautiful piece of paper. I'm sure it's a great comfort to the folks in Florida today.
Who cares? The police, FBI, and school officials were given scores of warnings that this guy was sick and violent, and they did nothing. This is the fundamental foundation of action. Maybe if the police actually charged this beast with a crime, maybe the system might not have ever gotten him the help he needed, or at least locked his ass up where he couldn't hurt anybody. But that's a discussion for another day. First, we need a system where when somebody with a violent history tells the whole world they want to kill their classmates, the people we pay to protect us will actually do something.
And then there is the truth that mental instability by itself is not a great predictor of a mass shooting. Most mentally ill people do not commit murder. So even if we fund the mental health reforms, how do we find the potentially deadly needles in these haystacks who are likely to blow?
She's right, but we can certainly narrow things down by looking at the ones who are violent. I have in the show notes a very interesting paper by Don Cates and Daniel Palsby called The Myth of the Virgin Killer. In a nutshell, the paper looks at people who have committed murders and finds that they don't just suddenly commit one of the darkest crimes humanity knows. Instead, they work their way up with ever-escalating violent crime, much like the behavior of the Parkland shooter.
Well, we could start by paying attention to things like Facebook posts with ominous gun pictures, coupled with social alienation and other red flag warning signs.
Be careful there, Megan. Those who are anti-gun often see any pictures of firearms to be ominous. And funny you mentioned Facebook and social alienation in the same sentence. See, Facebook is getting more and more anti-gun and trying to squeeze even the most mainstream gun content out of their platform. Same with YouTube and Google. Heck, the corporate anti-gun lobby is pushing banks to stop issuing lines of credit for gun sales and demanding groups drop retail products or stock investments if a company even has a passing tie to a firearms or ammunition manufacturer. Social alienation is one of the agenda items for the corporate anti-gun lobby. Funny you should call one of their political goals a red flag.
They say 6 to 10 million AR-15s, like the one reportedly used in Florida. So now we've seen it a million times. We're going to debate that gun. But any semi-automatic pistol can unleash carnage. There was no AR-15 at Virginia Tech, and that remains the worst school shooting in U.S. history. 32 dead. Nothing changed.
And this is why the anti-gun legislation has nothing to do with the shooting that they are using for a springboard. Because this isn't about guns. It's about disparity of force. The anti-gun forces want all the guns gone, so that way there won't be any more shootings. That's really laughable, as even nations where guns are all but illegal for private citizens, they still have shootings. It also ignores all the spree shooting events that were stopped by an actual good person with a gun, the most recent being the killings in Sutherland Springs, Texas, where a man with an AR-15 stopped the killer even before the police could respond. I have an article with even more events like this in the show notes. The news talks a big talk when everything goes wrong and the killer has free rein over what are layers and layers of gun control laws, but doesn't spend much time seeing what happens when a sick individual picks on people who are legally armed.
My children, like yours, have to practice hiding in the bathroom to avoid an active shooter and don't even think about letting the teacher lead a prayer to get them through that moment because the guns are perfectly legal, but the prayers are not.
Even worse, Megan. The prayers are likely just against school policy, while bringing a gun on campus is against the law. But so is the act of murder. How about we end this foolish policy of making schools gun-free zones with little to no additional security and give our teachers and students a prayer at survival before we even bother talking about school prayer as a policy?
I wish I had the solution. One part of it is courage. To get honest, to give a damn, to maybe take that $25 billion for the border wall and, as my friend Geraldo Rivera suggested, redirect it toward this problem? How about showing any resolve at all?
What kind of resolve are you showing, Megan? You've just ranted and raved about what we aren't going to do. But when it comes to what we should do, the best you have is throw money at it, even without saying what this money is supposed to do? I've just presented some solutions. The anti-gun corporate lobby doesn't like that because it doesn't include banning guns. But honestly, they also won't like it because, unlike their agenda, my solutions have the potential of working, while their policies have failed every time they've been implemented. Those are your anti-gun talking points and a few rebuttals to combat them.
So I like how she talks about being pregnant during the Sandy Hook murders as if that has anything at all to do with the topic. I mean, she's pretty clearly trying for an appeal to authority based on the fact that she's a mother. Oh, I was pregnant with the baby and children were killed. Therefore, because I have children, I should be listened to when it comes to gun policy. That's false. For crying out loud, if we're going to go that route, then just about anyone who has ever been related to anything, I was in a car wreck. So that makes me an authority on traffic congestion and national transportation policy. Bull.
Yeah. Well, but of course, also there's the double standard is the fact that, hey, I'm a dad. I've got a little girl. And yeah, no, I'm pro Second Amendment. They don't care. I'm not the parents that they care about. You know, the same thing goes with the pro Second Amendment students at the Parkland High School. There was quite a few kids that are like, yeah, no, this is not a gun control issue. There are other issues at hand here. And they're like, yeah, well, guess what? We're not going to give you any news time. We're going to give news time to the people that are taking the Bloomberg money.
So in news related to that aside, interestingly enough, you may have heard that within the past week or so, there was this big, huge stinking deal made about how a teacher in California fired a gun within a classroom and hurt a student. And oh my God. And this is being passed around as if it were ironclad proof that teachers shouldn't be armed. Except for the fact that teachers in California already aren't allowed to be armed. As anyone who knows anything about gun policy in California at all will realize. As it turns out, this teacher is a reserve police officer. You know, one of the only ones. And so even though the article makes it sound like the teacher shot the student, what actually happened is that the reserve police officer negligently discharged his pistol into the ceiling, and pieces of the ceiling fell and struck two students, and a third was struck either by debris or fragments of the bullet. It's still undetermined at this time. And this isn't proof that we shouldn't arm teachers. This is yet another case of an only one with government-approved sprinkles being negligent in a school. And so once again, just like Megyn Kelly, the antis are arguing in bad faith.
Yeah, and I think with some of that only one business, when you get to the super anti-gun rarefied air, they put police officers maybe up on too high of a platform, because this isn't a case of them not being trained enough. Police officers get training, and I don't think that there's any more training that would have prevented this. I think this is just a question of someone who carries a gun every day and has become complacent with it. And that's something that I always, especially as, you know, me, I'm a, you know, hardcore gun nut. I got a gun. I carry a gun every day. You can't take it for granted. You have to always remember, no, this is a dangerous thing. You have to always be cautious with your firearm. Now it's time for the Savage 1R segment. This week, Savage talks about how one actually gets some of those cryptocurrencies we've been all hearing so much about.
Hello, this is Savage 1R, and welcome to my segment where I talk about everything from freedom to firearms to financing, and we're going to be continuing our conversation on cryptocurrencies. Now, I'd like to reiterate that a cryptocurrency is simply a digital asset, or sometimes they can be considered a security that performs a function. That function may be as a currency, a hold or store of value, or it may be a digital asset that changes form or performs different functions that you can allocate to do different things. It's really wide open right now. It's the Wild West. Anything goes. But back to the subject at hand, how do you get a hold of your digital assets? How do you turn a dollar into a Bitcoin, for example? Well, I'll get to that. But first, before I do, let's have a little disclaimer. I am not a financial expert. I am not an expert in cryptocurrency. I'm just a guy who has been educating myself on the subject as much as I can, and I'm relaying my thoughts and opinions. Do not take any of this as professional financial advice. I am not responsible for any decisions you may make. Your money is your personal responsibility. I just have some ideas on how to make it grow. So this week, again, we're going to be talking about how to turn your dollars into donuts, or digital currency, I guess you could say. There's a few different exchanges out there that exchange cash for cryptocurrency, but the simplest and easiest way that I have found to do it is through Coinbase. Now, I don't have any kind of special arrangement with Coinbase. I simply found it the easiest way to on-ramp, and that's what this is called, on-ramping. So what you want to do is go over to Coinbase.com and create yourself an account. And once you've created yourself an account, you're going to want to sign up for two-factor authentication. Coinbase is going to give you a QR code and a number of letters and numbers, I believe. And what you're going to want to do is go onto your Android or Apple device, and you're going to download Google Authenticator. So with that Google Authenticator, you're going to take a picture of that QR code, and it's going to set yourself up an account on the Google Authenticator that will give you a set of numbers that you're going to use to log in every time you log into your Coinbase account. This is very important. It's another layer of security that you're going to need in order to protect yourself from hackers and thieves and phishers and whatnot. So you want to make sure that your digital assets are safe. So now that you've found yourself logged in, look on the top toolbar and go to the buy and sell option. Once there, you're going to find a section called the payment method, and you'll click on add a new account. It will allow you to either add a bank account, which is recommended, a debit card, or a wire transfer. They used to do credit cards, but obviously that can lead to certain abuses, and if you end up buying a bunch of Bitcoin and the value of your Bitcoin goes through the floor, you're going to be underwater and having to pay some pretty big bills if you're not paying attention. So at all costs, do not use credit cards. It's a bad idea to spend other people's money to try and make money by yourself. It ends up being kind of like a Ponzi scheme, and it just is not going to work out well for you. So don't do it. So now you've linked up your bank account. So what you're going to want to do is buy. What's the secret of buying? Buy when it's low and sell when it's high. You're going to want to watch the price of Bitcoin, and you're going to want to find points in time in which it goes down below what its normal price is. So like say the other day when I was making my recording and the price of Bitcoin was like $11,500 or something, and now today when I'm looking at the price of Bitcoin at this moment in time, it's $9,737. So it's gone down a bit, and it would be a great time to buy some. So there's a big click on buy Bitcoin button that's available right on Coinbase that you can do it the easy way. You simply say how much money you're willing to spend, and Coinbase will do the calculations for you. It will figure out how much money, like say if you want to spend $100, it will calculate how much Bitcoin that will buy, and you click on the buy it now button, and it will lock in that purchase price. Now that's important because the purchase isn't going to happen right away. What's going to happen is Coinbase is going to lock in that purchase price. So they're going to set aside that amount of Bitcoin for you while it takes time for the cash from your bank account to be transferred over to Coinbase. It usually takes 5 to 7 days to happen. But once that transfer happens, you'll find that amount of Bitcoin that you purchased in your Coinbase account. Now, there are some issues doing it this way because when you buy through Coinbase, this is while it's the easy mode, you're also having to pay a little bit of a premium because not only do you have to pay a Coinbase fee, what's their basically their usage fee for that, they're also selling it to you at a little bit of a premium. Say the price they're selling it is $9,737, but if you look on the other exchanges, maybe it's trading at $9,727. So you're paying a little bit of a premium on the price and you're paying a little bit of a fee, but you're able to lock in that fee immediately instead of having to wait for your funds to transfer 5 to 7 days from now, and then you might miss out on the gains that could have been made if you bought right away. So that's the easy mode. That's the way to get in and just do it like any other grandma and grandpa or mom and dad would do it. Now, the hard mode is a little bit different. So Coinbase owns its own personal exchange, and that exchange is called GDAX. And when you have a Coinbase account, you have a GDAX account. They're both created at the same time. So in order to make use of that, you would go over to GDAX.com, sign in, and let's say you had transferred money over to your Coinbase account, but you hadn't decided to buy Bitcoin, because that's also another option. You can also transfer funds to a Coinbase account without actually buying any Bitcoin or other cryptocurrency. So once in GDAX, you can select transfer funds, and you will transfer your dollar amount from Coinbase to a dollar account on GDAX, and then you will go into the general order form. Now, the order form is on the left-hand side of the screen. It gives you a couple different options. You have a market buy or sell, a limit buy or sell, or a stop buy or sell. Now, we're not going to focus on the market or the stop, because those ones tend to cost you money, and we're trying to save you money at all costs at this point. So let's talk about a limit buy. GDAX is very helpful, and they give you a bunch of frequently asked questions where you can go and find out how things work. For today, we're just going to talk about limit orders. There's two options under the limit. You have the post only and the allow taker. So post only option will ensure that the order is only executed if the entire order can be posted to the order book. If any part of the order crossed the spread to fill an existing order, an error will be displayed and the order will not be executed. This is useful for guaranteeing that the entire order is subject to a 0% maker order fee. So again, there is no fee associated with it. Now, allow taker will allow the order to be executed regardless of whether it crosses the spread to fill an existing order. If any part of the order crosses the spread, that portion will be assessed the taker fee rate. So when you place an order, it will be shown in several views, including the open orders, the order book, and the depth chart. A basic limit order may be partially filled and is subject to price improvement. You may get an even better price than you asked for. So what you'll do is you will click on the amount of Bitcoin you want to do, and you're going to have to do a little bit of math on this one. So say I wanted to buy $1,000 worth of Bitcoin, and the price of Bitcoin is at $9,663. So I would do 1,000 divided by $9,663, and that gives me 0.1034 Bitcoins. So in the amount section, I would put 0.1034, and in the limit price, I would put 1,000 USD. And that would be under post only. Once you've got that in order, then you click on place buy order. Once a seller is willing to sell at the price, you know, because you have to pick at the level that it's selling at, above or below, depending. So if you wanted to buy higher, which I don't know why you'd want to do, then you'd place an order for when the price is higher. Generally, you want to place an order for when the price is lower. So if it's 9,667, you'd do it for 9,666, or maybe you'd hope it fall a little bit farther. So then you'd place an order down farther in order to buy at a lower price. So now you've got your Bitcoin. You did it. So now what do you do? Well, the point of getting the Bitcoin is to gain value. The only way you can gain value is over time. Now, over time, it may go down and you may lose value, or it may go up and you'd gain value. Like I said before, the point is to buy low and sell high. So you wouldn't buy at a higher price and then sell when it drops. That's when you'd actually buy more, is when it's gone down a significant amount. And you'd wait till it goes above the spot where you bought it if you're going to sell it. Now, selling on a limit order is the exact same method. You do the math for however much Bitcoin you want to sell, and you set the sell price for what the cash amount should be, and then you place a sell order. But what happens at that point is you've now created a taxable event. Every time you gain value in an asset, whether it's digital or otherwise, you have created a taxable event. So you'll get money back, the money that you've profited, but then you'll also owe taxes on that profits. If it's a short-term gain, which is under a year, it could be upwards of 25 or 30%. If it's long-term gains, where you take that money out after a year, I think it's somewhere between 15 to 20%. So it's up to you to decide how much taxes you want to pay and when you pull out your money. So that's a very brief overview on how to buy and sell Bitcoin. There's other digital assets available on GDAX and Coinbase, such as Bitcoin Cash, Ether, and Litecoin. All four of those cryptocurrencies have different attributes. Some of them have similar functions, and some of them have actually very different functions. But they all are basically a store value that should gain over time. I think that'll do it for me for today. Thanks for listening. Next time, we'll talk about how to trade one digital asset for another, where you can do it, and what you can gain from it. If you want to help support my segment, please go into the show notes and click on the various referral links for the different exchanges that are available. There should be one from Coinbase, as well as Binance, which is another great exchange that I really enjoy using. You guys have a great one, and I'll see you later.
Last week, I referred to a particular cryptocurrency as Dogecoin. Savage1R informs me that it is properly pronounced Dogecoin. I regret the error, and shall flog myself with a limp noodle 50 times as penance.
We're actually going to be debating the pronunciation of typos on Japanese memes?
Memes! It's memes, you reprobate.
Memes. I'm going on the Dawkins pronunciation.
Oh, God. You know, this is just a perfect dovetail because I understand you sat down with Gail Pepin of the Masada Ayoub Group for an interview. And I'm so glad that the show notes here have it spelled P-E-P-P-I-N. Because every time I have seen her name, and I don't know why, I call her Gail Pepin. I cannot tell you why this is. It's just, it's always Gail Pepin. And every time I said that on the old podcast, Sean would cut in. It's like, it's Pepin. So, weird. Having sat down with Gail Pepin, what did you talk about in your interview?
We had another origin story. It turns out that Gail Pepin of the Masada Ayoub Group hasn't always been the ardent Second Amendment supporter her whole life. All right, joining me now is Gail Pepin of the Masada Ayoub Group. How you doing, Gail?
I'm great. How are you, Weird?
I am doing just fine. So we talked before on the Gunblog Variety Cast. We met for the first time at the NRA annual meeting last year. And I thought
we had a great time, didn't we?
We really did. We really did. We crashed the Mayors Against Illegal Guns, or there was the Moms Demand Action.
Yeah.
We crashed their party, and that was a whole lot of fun.
It was a blast.
Yeah, and I did an interview with you there, and I felt it was really interesting. And I think with this new show, there might be some new ears, so I think they might want to hear your story. And so I was surprised to find out that, you know, you're such a well-known shooter within that, and you're with the Masada Ayoub Group, but you didn't always start out as the gun-toting mama that you are.
No, I really didn't. Growing up in Chicago, guns were pretty forbidden. It wasn't legal for us to own guns. They were pretty darn vilified in the media with everybody I knew. I didn't know anybody who really had guns as I was growing up. When I got a little bit older, I did. Like, my mother-in-law had a gun, but that was kind of like hush-hush, you know, that kind of stuff. It was always on the hushy-hushy side because, you know, it just wasn't part of our experience there in Chicago.
Well, not to incriminate, but was it hush-hush because it was just, it was gauche, it was socially gauche, or was it hush-hush because it might not have been fully legal?
Probably a little bit of both.
Yeah. I mean, and also that just comes with the rat's nest of laws. Like, I mean, I remember my wife got her credit card stolen, and a police officer came to fill out the theft report, and I was just nervous on the, oh, please don't go look in my gun room. I think everything's legal, but I live in Massachusetts, and so maybe it's not. So that, you know, that you always get that question of the you don't want to paint a target on your back, because someone's going to find one little statute that's out of whack.
Right, because, you know, it just seems like there are so many laws and so many hoops that you have to jump through. You become a lawbreaker, not by intent, but by just stumbling into it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like that stock that Sig makes for that, for the AR pistol.
Yeah, the arm brace.
The arm brace, that's what it is. Yeah, if you shoot it from your arm, from your hand, it's legal. You put it on your shoulder, you're breaking the law.
Well, now they've clarified that says that's not the case, but no laws were ever changed at any point in time. It went from legal to illegal to legal again.
So what's the cop who's at your house going to do? He doesn't know, because you don't know, because nobody knows, so they change it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's ridiculous. But, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, if you have an AR and you live metropolitan Chicago area, you're still in Cook County. Is it legal in Cook County? Is it not legal in Cook County? Is it 10-round magazine, 20-round magazine? Can I have a forward grip? Can I not have a forward grip? Can you have a laser? No, I can't have a laser in Cook County. So, you know, all these things. You're not breaking the law on purpose, but you break the law just because the laws are so screwed up.
Yep. So overall,
I digressed, didn't I?
Yeah, that's fine. It's an interesting digression. It was good stuff. I'm not going to stop you when it's good. But your views were, is it mostly just that you felt that guns were bad, or were you just intimidated by them? Did you just think they were, you know, a means to an evil end?
Well, pretty much when you live in the city, the only people with guns are the cops and the gangbangers.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the cops are there to protect people, and the gangbangers, you know, were shooting out. It's much worse today. Oh, my God. Today, it's so much more horrible with the gangbangers in Chicago than it was. But that was kind of the thing, you know, that either the good guys had them or the bad guys had them. There was no everybody else who has them.
Mm-hmm.
And which it was black and white. There was no shades of gray. When I got older, when I was an adult, I was a little bit more accepting of it. But now I didn't have any, not really. I was a vegetarian for about 15 years, and I did it for health reasons. But, you know, the political reasons started coming in, reading the, you know, the books and the magazines, and I was really opposed to hunting, and that's where I hated the NRA, because the NRA armed hunters. So at that point, I was reading all, you know, the vegetarian stuff. You know, it got into politics just as much as it got into health, and I hated the NRA because the ad said, I am the NRA, and I arm hunters, and they kill Bambi in the woods and all that. So that kind of reinforced the, you know, I don't like guns thing. I don't like guns thing.
So what changed?
What changed? I was probably in my mid-30s, I think, and I had a group of friends that I used to go out with. We would go to dinner, we would go to functions, there's people that hung out, and we would discuss anything. We were free to discuss anything within our group with no hard feelings, no ramifications. It was just open. We would just talk about anything and everything, you know, all kinds of political views and every side of every issue. So one of the guys that was in our group, he was a military gun collector. I didn't know that, but he was. And he, one of the other people said, well, what about those Second Amendment people? They seem really, really passionate about what they believe in. What's that all about? We're talking about it and talking about it. And the one guy said, well, I collect military guns. I collect military rifles. I said, well, we should all go out and try it and see. So we all went. There was like 6 or 8, maybe 10 of us. We went and we all took a basic NRA class. I took it with another woman, and the other guys all took it separately. And we started shooting together. And like, this is really cool. So we made it a regular thing. We go out and shoot the military rifles in the outdoor range. And we had like a monthly get together. You know, we made our monthly get together at the range. So we kind of just got into it. We learned about it. We educated ourselves on it. We said, hey, you know, this isn't so bad. It's not so scary. This is actually fun. And I kind of continued and kept going on, getting more and more training. You know, I took, in order to get my FOID card, which you had to have in Illinois to even touch a gun or a bullet.
What class did you take?
Like a basic NRA, not even NRA class. Some guy at the range who was a range that used to be out by O'Hare. And it was a couple hours class. It was a good class. Brought different kinds of guns, and we tested them, and, you know, saw what we like, and he shot, and we shot, and we had a real good time. So that enabled us to get our FOID cards, and then we started going on a regular basis. And as we were going, I wanted to learn more because I've always wanted to learn more about everything. So I started taking more and more classes and kind of went beyond what everybody else did and started competing and, you know, really getting into it and really getting involved and learning. I learned that it's not so scary. You know, I don't hate the NRA anymore. I'm a life member because it's not about hunting Bambi in the woods. You know, I went to it for more of the self-defense way, more of a skill building thing, more just learning about things. I've always liked mechanical things, guns and mechanical things. It was just interesting to me. And I met some great people, some of the nicest people you ever want to meet, you meet on the range.
Did you, your first trip to the range, was there some expectations that were horribly shattered? Because I always find that a lot of people are surprised at how controlled a good shooting range is.
No, I don't think so. You know, when I was a kid, I kind of skipped over this. My uncle used to have a gun. I'd forgotten about that. He lived out in the country, and he had a gun. So I had been with him. He used to shoot rats in the corn crib, you know, that kind of stuff. So I had been out with him doing that. So I knew how loud it would be. I knew, you know, I knew about loudness and recoil and that stuff. I wasn't surprised by that stuff. The control thing, I don't know. I think I expected it to be controlled, and it was controlled. It was
good. I think I felt it myself, even though my first time shooting was in somebody's backyard up in Maine. So of course, it's going to be controlled. It's just the three of us. But
right.
I kind of expected, you know, shooting ranges to be a little bit more willy-nilly, you know, a little bit more on the air of danger, especially since there's so much activity that, you know, people do. You know, you ride dirt bikes around, right. Or, you know, I learned to shoot a bow and arrow in my backyard, and it's the amount of safety just taken into those things that aren't firearms and don't have groups really like the NRA teaching safety.
Right.
Just don't have there's a little air of this is something dangerous, you know, you might get hurt and all that versus, you know, at the gun range. Yeah. If you get hurt, maybe, you know, got M1 thumb.
Yeah. I don't think I had any preconceived notions what it was going to be like. So I don't think I was nothing was confirmed or denied. It was very safe. There's a lot of rules to remember, which kind of threw me at first. Like, they call all clear, everybody puts their guns down, steps away. I didn't know that. You know, I had to learn all that kind of stuff, which is, I went in with an open mind, so I was kind of like ready to learn. I didn't really have any preconceived ideas of what it was going to be like. I just kind of went in there like an empty vessel, I guess, and just kind of absorbed, like, this is the way they do it. This place has different rules. This place has different procedures, and I'm going to learn them.
Well, I think that's all great stuff. So any way that got you up into the higher echelon of the work that you do, or was it just a steady, you just got into training, doing more training, eventually met Mass and you guys started working together?
Yeah, I was doing more and more training. I was looking for classes. I had found a class at Midwest Sporting Goods in Lyons, Illinois. And I guess I was lucky, because I stumbled on good instructors right away. I didn't stumble on bad instructors, and there's a lot of bad instructors out there.
Mm-hmm.
So I stumbled upon, his name was Jack, and he taught at the range there. And he was a crusty old Chicago cop, didn't take any bullshit, and I just loved him to death. And he was tough on us, and we performed, and, you know, he trained us. He goes, we're training you like you're training cops. This isn't practice, this is training. And he would be real serious and real regimented about it, and it was good training. It was very good training, and I learned a lot. Then I found at that range where I was training with Mass, with Jack, every Thursday night we would go. There was a sign up there for another class from Masada Youp. I'm like, oh, maybe I'll take that. So I took that, and I took the two-day shooting portion, and I took that with Midwest Training Group. Mass didn't teach it. He has different instructors that teach it around the country. And Andy and Bob were the ones who were teaching it in Illinois from Midwest Training Group. I took that class, the two-day shooting, and they're like, you really need to take the two-day classroom. And I said, nah, I don't need that. I just want to learn how to shoot. I want to learn all that theory stuff. I just want to learn how to shoot. I just want to get better at shooting. But they said, no, you really need to take it. And this one guy in there, he was a local cop, and he said, you know, you got to take it. I took it. It was life-changing. Like, all right, well, maybe I'll take it. Well, I did. I did take it. I took it. There was a couple guys that I shot with who were in the class too, and I sat in the front row, and the rest is history. So
that's awesome.
How I met Mass, and we just kind of clicked. We went out after the class, after I'd graduated, and had a few drinks, and just been with him ever since.
Well, that's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's just a great story, and it just shows that, I mean, I guess one common thing for why someone might be attracted to the anti-gun views is they don't know anything about guns. They're just, and they hear things. Some of the things might be Hollywood that's just pure fiction, or might be, you know, prefabricated propaganda, which is either, you know, not true or bending the truth, and that might lead them astray. And so all you need to do is be nice to someone and be honest to someone, and it can make a vast change in their life.
It is. You know what? You have to have an open mind. And so many people don't have an open mind. You know, I was open to try something new. You know, I thought I hated the NRA. I thought I hated gun people. But they were all so nice and all so accepting and giving. People would say, here, shoot my gun, shoot my ammo. You know, they were all very, very nice to me. I'm like, you know, all this stuff I've been hearing is not really true. You know, I still don't hunt. I'm still not a hunter. I'll never be a hunter. But that's okay, because Second Amendment's not about hunting. No matter how many times they tell you it's about hunting, it's not. It's about self-protection. It's about government protection. Keep an open mind. If your mind is so closed, you only see it one way, you're never going to grow and you're never going to learn anything. And that goes for both sides.
Well, that's awesome. Thank you so much, Gail Pepin of the Masada Yub Group and the Pro Arms Podcast. And anything else you want to plug, Gail?
Well, the Pro Arms Podcast is currently on hiatus, but we're sleeping, but we're not dead, but we're just resting. We're just so busy with Masada Yub Group that I had to let something go, and the podcast had to put on hiatus for a while. But we're going to NRA pretty soon. Are you going to be there, Weird?
I'm going to be there.
I will see you there.
You absolutely
Maybe we can
will.
Cause more mayhem.
Oh, I would love to. I hope there'll be mayhem to cause.
We'll bring it.
Wasn't that fun, Aaron?
It sure was.
I love Gail. I had so much fun hanging out with her last year at the NRA show, and she's going to be back again this year. So it's hopefully there'll be another protest for us to go to.
Yeah, Gail is a sweetheart. She's one of my favorite people. Last year in October at Gun Rights Policy Conference, not only did I get to hang out with her, but she interviewed me for her podcast. It hasn't aired yet because, like Gail said, the Pro Arms podcast is on hiatus, but maybe someday in her copious free time, she'll get back to that and you'll be able to hear the interview. And I thought it was pretty good because, well, I give good interview.
You also took a class with the Masada Yub Group, didn't you?
I did, but she didn't do much of the instruction. It was mostly Moss. Mass? I don't know. Okay, so his full name is Masad, and so I want to abbreviate that to Moss, but Moss sounds, well, mossy, and he wants people to call him Mass, but it's not Massad. This is where my brain goes. So
this is from someone who grew up in Massachusetts and New Hampshire, so he's got that New England accent.
So while I did see her at Mag 40 last year, she didn't do any teaching. And of course, this was the same Mag class where I got sick with some sort of crud and was throwing up the last day. Still managed to shoot a qualifier, though, so that's good.
Did you take it an additional day, or did you manage to do it even with being ill?
So here's what happened. Brief recap for people who didn't hear about this last time. So it was the last day of class, and we were shooting our qualifier, and then we were going to go back to the classroom and take the test because there had been some rainouts. And I started throwing up actually on the range, and I just thought it was nerves. So I didn't feel great. I shot enough to qualify. I don't remember my actual score anymore. I got somewhere in the B to B plus range. And it's like, well, I'm not happy, but I passed. And we got back to the classroom, and I just started throwing up my toenails. And it was so bad that I could not do anything, and I crawled off to another room to lie down and be sick. And so I missed the test, but I worked things out with Masad and the other instructors because the NRA annual meeting was in Atlanta, and that's within driving distance of me. And Live Oak is, it's a slight detour, but it's on the way. And so I just worked out and I said, hey, how about I leave a little bit early? I'll stop by. You'll give me the last presentation. I'll take the test. We'll see what happens. And they were very accommodating and I passed with 100%. So yeah, I did have to make it up, but they were very nice about that. And I passed. Yay, go B.
I really need to take that class. That is high on my list for training that needs to be done.
Oh my God, yes. Yes. I mean, not only because it's excellent training, but because Mossad is an absolute hoot and he's not getting any younger. We've lost so many good trainers and we don't want to lose Mossad in another helicopter crash.
Oh God. Forgot about the helicopter crash. I think that does it for another show of the Sorted Calibers podcast. Thanks to all who are listening. And make sure to tell your friends if you like what you heard.
Now, if you're listening, you probably already know about this, but just in case you haven't, our podcast has a Facebook group. In fact, we inherited the old Gunblog Variety Cast community page from Sean. He gave it to us. And so if you are interested in finding out some behind-the-scenes stories, what's going to happen, what's coming up next, join the group, and you can get a little inside podcast as to what's going on.
You can also hear more from me at my blog at weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com. Also, I'm co-host of the Handgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network.
And you can find me at workingrhythmically.blogspot.com.
You can find more of Savage 1R on the We Like Shooting podcast. And thanks to Nate Spencer for our show's music.
He's Weirdy. I'm Pony. Together, we're Weirdy and Pony, but that's not a good podcast name. So, we're the Assorted Calibers podcast. See you next week, everyone.